Get on up.
Everybody right there.
Get into it.
Everybody right there.
Get involved.
Everybody, you. Come on. Come on.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. Protest music. We're going to talk about that for the next hour. Protest music is more than just Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. It can be James Brown, as we heard there. In studio, we're really, really fortunate to have two really great guests. We have Bow Graves. How you doing there? The executive director of the Old Town School of Folk Music. And we have Martez Rucker, vocalist, pianist, composer, arranger, and you currently serve on the voice, piano, and jazz faculty of Columbia College in Chicago. And you guys are on because next Saturday, as part of the Chicago Voices series, actually, there's a panel on protest music called Modern Protest Songs. It'll be 11:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, February 4th, Film Row, 8th floor, 1104 South Wabash. You guys will be there, Rick Wilson, artist, performer, and prison abolitionist, and myself. So thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure indeed.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So it's a big subject. It's a timely subject. Let's just start with how do you guys define protest music?
Well, that can go a couple of different ways. Mm-hmm. We can start with the classic definition of a song that describes the compelling need of a topic that and its purpose is to draw in attention to start a discussion on said topic, or we can go with the direction of it's just a song sung at a protest. Now, if you go with the first definition, that opens up a very wide door, whereas the second one's very narrow as to what actually happens on the stage at the protest. I like to go with the first definition because that involves everything and it allows for more discussion rather than just keeping it narrow.
Bob?
Well, I was down at the Women's March a week ago, and there was so much just loving energy in the air. It was a really warm, meaningful, joyous event. But the one thing about it that really surprised me was that there was almost no singing. There was a few chants of this is what democracy looks like and so forth, but there were not any songs being sung. And I couldn't remember being to a political demonstration in which music hadn't had a very primary role. It certainly had an important role all through the history of politics in the 20th century, through the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. Mm-hmm. It's inconceivable to think about them without the musical component, and it made me think, boy, this generation really needs to create a batch of good, new, patriotic protest songs.
I said the same thing. I marched on Friday night, and I was with my friend John Soss, a fan of the show. He's been on the show, and I said the exact same thing. I go, where is this? Where's the music? And it can be other things besides, I mean, I think there was a brass band marching around Friday night, but mm-hmm. hip-hop and stuff. What are you seeing from the streets, emerging from the streets in response to what's going on?
Well, what I'm seeing is that since we live in a generation where everything is shrunk down to 140 characters, that the original role of the protest song has started to dissipate. I mean, in the past, it wasn't just all for the singing purposes at a march. It was more so as a unifying factor. And when we have people coming from this side of the town to that side of the town just to march in a specific place, one, they don't know quite surely what they're marching for, and two, they haven't given much thought as to how to show that they're protesting the same thing, which is what was going on with the labor movements. Everyone got together and they said, we're going to sing this, this, and that, so that it shows it, and the same with the civil rights movement. So it leaves a void to where all we're reduced to now is just a couple of eponymous chants, you know, with certain rhythms that everybody can just jump onto, and it doesn't quite get across the message, which is why some of these protests, while stirring to see, don't quite portray to the other side of the wall.
You know, you mentioned civil rights, and I've done a book, and the Sun-Times, I did a lot of stories, and Curtis Mayfield, the Staple Singers, the different ways a protest song can go. Mavis would call them message songs, mm-hmm. you know. Can a protest song, and we're going to play a snippet of Curtis Mayfield a little bit, but, I mean, that's can lead you to understanding. So is a protest song that one avenue, or is it also agitation and to take action, or can it be both?
Oh, I think it totally can be both.
Yes.
But there's songs that are good for different things. A lot of the classic protest songs, you take a song like Masters of War, something by Bob Dylan, or Give Peace a Chance. You know, it's got that catchy, all we are saying is give peace a chance. But then John Lennon goes off into this rap that nobody can remember those words. John Lennon probably couldn't even remember those words. He made them up on the spot. So a song like Masters of War or Give Peace a Chance is great for people listening on the radio or at home playing and getting inspired by it. But if you want something that's going to help people out there on the street when they're marching, it's got to have a really simple chorus, only a handful of words that are really easy to remember. It's why a song like We Shall Overcome is such a classic song of protest, because there's only about 12 words in the entire song, mm-hmm. and they're repeated over and over again in a beautiful cadence, but anybody can pick that song up in one chorus.
Yeah. Right, and I'm glad you brought that specific song up, because it also leads to improvisation. For example, the verse We Are Not Afraid was not written. That was not a planned verse. That came about because they saw what was in front of them, and out of fear to calm themselves, one person led out singing We Are Not Afraid. And that has now become iconic with the rest of the song. So what you're saying is very true, that the song can be both, and there is a place and time for both. At the rallies is where we need that simple chorus. If they're only saying, all that I'm saying is give peace a chance, and that became the chant that fueled the march, that would be one thing. And then when you're at home, now you have the chance to listen to everything else that John Lennon was saying, or everything else that another artist will be saying, describing why we need to give peace a chance. So it definitely has a place in both worlds.
Mavis and our dear friend Gene Barge, who's been on the show, we've talked about the Push concerts and Operation Breadbasket. And I was thinking about this a lot today, what we're talking about tonight, and how they would have those rallies and every Saturday at the International Amphitheater. And mm-hmm. it's made me think people should be doing that right now. Like at the Old Town School, you should have a rally every Saturday for this stuff.
Yeah, well, then we need to come up with that new batch of songs.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, last weekend was well and good, but you got to keep at it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's music that helps to drive any movement. Well, sometimes I think that part of the malaise of contemporary labor is that unions aren't singing unions anymore. Back in the days when everybody knew the songs, you know, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, and I'm sticking to the union until the day I die. That would motivate a bunch of people out on the picket line. But somewhere along the line, our unions forgot how to sing. And look what rotten condition they're in now.
Yeah. at the Old Town School, even during the election and stuff, was there... is there more interest in this? Were people asking questions about protest songs, political songs, or has it always been at one level there? Or?
Well, Old Town School, you know, we were born in 1957, just sort of as the folk scare and the civil rights movement were both taking off. So there's always been a pretty wide streak of socially engaged music at Old Town School. It's always been a part of what we do. So that sort of never left our DNA. But it sure does feel like the times are demanding it more.
Yeah, I mean, I was lamenting. I mean, I wasn't in Cleveland, but I know one artist I know that was on the front line, but I don't know, it was the Tom Morello's band, you know, okay. and they were there, and they were protesting and singing in the streets and stuff, but I don't know of much else that was going on, even during the RNC.
Yeah, no, I don't either, not much.
Can we talk about the different types of protest music? I mean, sure. It's more than, I mean, you know, in some of my notes here, I mean, I've got Run the Jewels, of course, Patti Smith, People Have the Power, The Clash, Sandinista, one of my all-time favorite protest albums and stuff. Talk about the different forms of it.
Well, if we're going to go into the different genres and different forms, I mean, you've got your freedom songs, which of course came from the gospel tradition, the spirituals from the fields, which is your We Shall Overcomes, your I'm forgetting right
yeah,
now.
Oh, freedom! I shall not be moved.
You're right. I shall not be moved.
On my way.
Yes, those songs. Then you've got your other songs that have, as we call them, like your statement pieces, your message songs, Respect Yourself, or Wake Up Everybody, or People Get Ready, Curtis Mayfield's. So you've got these, and then you've got now what's coming out more so are the ones that are aimed more so at stirring up the visceral anger. And they're speaking more so out of that emotion.
That's what I was getting at, like between understanding and that
right.
emotion.
I mean, we're starting to somewhat lose the balance between the two.
Yeah.
Because if you look at, Wake Up Everybody, No More Sleeping in Bed, it wasn't just a call to one side of the field. It was a call to understanding. And now we're starting to more so divide, which is how, if you look at the state of our protests, it's a very stark line. It's either you're for or you're against. There's no room for any gray area for there to be an understanding from both sides. Whereas it used to be, okay, I may not agree, but I understand where you're coming from. Now it's, if you don't agree, you're against me.
Yeah,
if you're
right.
not my friend, you're my enemy. And that kind of is a twist that this new generation has brought.
That's very interesting. We're going to take a break here, and we'll be back with more on protest music on WGN's Nocturnal Journal.
As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw below me the endless skyway. I saw below me those golden valleys. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. That's Bob Graves, Executive Director of Old Town School of Folk Music, with one of our favorite songs here. And we're also here with Martez Rucker from Columbia College. And we're all going to be on a panel on February 4th at Columbia College, moderated by you, Martez.
Yes, sir.
At 11:45, February 4th, Film Row, 8th floor, 1104 South Wabash, as part of the Chicago Voices series. When was the first time you heard that song?
I can't recall the first time I heard that song. I think that one is just sort of imprinted in all of our national consciousness. I'll tell you a good story about it, though. I've probably performed that song 1,000 times or more, and it's one that almost everybody at least knows the chorus to, and many of us know multiple verses. And I was participating in this leadership training program some years ago, and a few of us learned that each other were musicians, and we started bringing guitars and fiddles and instruments along, and during the breaks we would sing and play for a while. And one day we got singing This Land Is Your Land, and it was a wild and rowdy rendition of it, full of a lot of spirit. And when we finished it, there was one of the other participants in this leadership training program that happened to be a Native American woman. And she said, you know, some of us listen to that song and we don't feel quite so good about it. And it really set me back.
Yeah.
And I have to say that I stopped singing the song for a few years after that, because I felt like, holy cow, without even giving it a second thought, I've been singing this song that is potentially seen as prejudicial by the Native American community, and justifiably so. I mean, here's a white guy telling a bunch of other people this land is my land. I mean, I'm not quite sure where that fits in. But I came back to it because it is such a vital piece of American heritage. I sort of have felt like the song can still be a great song, but I'm glad that I've got that story to go along with it that helps to explain a little piece of that legacy that isn't always as hopeful as we might think.
Don't you think the meaning of that song's elevated right now?
I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. Marcus, what was I don't know much about your background. Where are you from originally?
I'm born on the south side of Chicago.
Okay.
Around 80th and Halsted. That's where home has been. Morgan Park High School. Columbia College is where I got my undergrad degree. Then I left and got my master's from Western Michigan University. And I've been back in the city ever since, teaching at Columbia College and then doing outreach in the communities.
You're a young man, right?
Yes,
and you're one of our best dressed guests we've had here. How old are you?
33.
33. Okay, so what was your exposure to this genre, to protest social music?
Well, in 2007, I was on my way to Western Michigan. I was finishing Columbia College and planning my next role, my next goal, I should say. And I came across a group at Columbia College called, at the time, it was Saturday Scholars, through the Community Center for Arts Partnerships of Columbia College. And they were taking 6th through high school students down to New Orleans shortly after Katrina. And they wanted to create a requiem in four parts based off of what Spike Lee did in When the Levees Broke. And I was called on to be the composer of the score. So I agree. You know, we see the movie, or we see the documentary. We meet Shakespeare, who was one of the poets at the end of the second act in front of the cemeteries. So I'm interested. I definitely want to go. And then we land. We take the bus. We step off the bus. We're right in the middle of New Orleans. And by this time, Katrina had been a year or two in passing, and it still looked like it just was there the week before. So when you see something like that, your eyes become opened. And at that point, I started researching everything I could about what was going on. Why is it still in this condition? And the more I saw, the sadder I became. But then at the same time, the sadder I became, the more motivated I became to try to do something about it. So I began to pour myself into that project and to pour myself into outreach as a whole so that our students are more educated about the world that's around them. And that's what led me to this genre.
And how do you do that?
Well, it starts with education.
Yeah.
Because a lot just don't know. I mean, as Ball was referring to, the background of the song, This Land Is Your Land, may be seen as less than happy for some people. What our students are taught, what they see, is all they know. So if they don't see outside of their window, they can't make informed decisions. So the idea of a protest, when they don't exactly know, A, what should be protests, or B, when they protest, what they're even protesting for and how it affects them, it leaves them at a very big loss. So that's why educating them became goal number one. And then goal number two, now that they know, how do they channel it? Because sometimes knowledge can be dangerous. Some things you know, you wish you didn't.
Yeah.
So I didn't want their education to turn to anger, especially unfocused anger, because that's when you have bad things happen. So educating them on what's going on and then giving them music as a avenue to channel it has become a very big part of my teaching culture.
That's fascinating. We got to take a break for the news here, but I want to pick up on that. Again, it's kind of with the thesis of what I want to talk about. Protest is understanding, or protest is anger. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
I'm gonna start me a hungry man's union. Ain't gonna charge no dues. Gonna march down the road to the wall walls, singing them 66 highway blues.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. We're here with Martez Rucker and Hal Graves from the Old Town School of Folk Music. And that's, we're talking about protest music. I want to play a cut of that. That's Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger doing 66 Highway Blues. And the lyrics, I mean, Seeger was singing there. I mean, sometimes I think I'll blow down a cop. Lord, you treat me so mean. I'm going to start me a hungry man's union. Ain't going to charge no dues. Going to march down that road to the Wall Street walls, singing those 66 Highway Blues. Now, at that time, that was pretty radical stuff. It was a Joe McCarthy era. So he kind of like, and tell me if I'm wrong, he kind of moved into like a more subversive commercial thing of like, where have all the flowers gone, to get a message across. And that was kind of picked up by Dylan and stuff. But tell me about that kind of progress.
About Pete's career?
Yeah, well, just not... Again, it was what we were talking about before the break, not being so heavy-handed with the message. Sometimes I think I'll blow down a cop. I mean, you know, that's going on today.
I don't think he ever backed off on any of his radical tendencies. I mean, he got called into the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he went in there and said, here, let me sing you some songs. But unlike some other figures, he wasn't naming names of other people who'd been members of the Communist Party or fellow travelers. But there's a direct connection to the history of Old Town School there. Our founder, Win Strachey, prior to founding Old Town School, he had a television show here in Chicago called Win's Animal Playhouse. And he had it for a number of years. And he was set upon by Joe McCarthy and was blacklisted. His name appeared in the Red Channel's book. And he was kicked off the air. He lost his job and was trying to figure out what to do next. And he was interested in folk music and said, well, I'm going to hook up with this guy, Frank Hamilton, who knows how to teach. And we're going to start a folk music school. And that was 1957.
Yeah. So yeah, we were talking about that before the break, about being heavy-handed, you know, mm-hmm. and trying to get the message across. I mean, I was thinking of playlists like Ooh Child by the Five Stair Steps. There's a song of great inspiration and stuff. So, and we were talking again during the break about, can we talk about the church as a unifier? I mean, stuff mm-hmm. coming out of the church. Sam Cooke came out of the church. Sam Cooke does A Change Is Gonna Come.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you've got, you know, Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come, and a lot of artists from that time all came from the church, and they were singing things like that. You got Someday We'll All Be Free, you know, and that's, again, a unifier, because the word all is something that was all-encompassing rather than dividing. And that's, when you have songs that unify, it brings them in. And when you bring in more people, it creates that understanding. So when you have songs like We Shall Overcome, or, you know, as we said, that's being a, you know, We Are Not Afraid, those type of songs, they all seem to come from that tradition of the gospel church, of the spirituals, where they were singing again for the liberation of all. And the protest movement picked up on that, and they saw that there was great wealth in the knowledge of being able to bring everything under one umbrella. So as long as the gospel influence has been felt, that message will continue to be strong. Now, where things have started to shift is when the gospel element started to be tapered out, and it started to go for more of a harder edge, whereas gospel moved to the left. Now we've got your rap, your rock moving in from the right, and you've got going from, you know, all that we're saying, give peace a chance, to Chuck D and Run DMC and NWA and that angle. And now we've gone more so from, you know, the subtlety of someday I'm going to blow down a cop, to the terms used, you know, towards the police, you know, because it's 187 on undercover cops. And now we've got problems.
Uh-huh.
And the more we go there, now the anger starts to creep back in.
What about connection and community? I mean, those are big, you know, words, but I want to talk about your book there, Cultural Democracy. And it's a process of continuous and intense community engagement using culture as a catalyst for addressing social issues. Art of the people, made by the people, and presented for the people. What does that mean? And tell me about your book.
Well, the basic idea of cultural democracy is that everybody's culture is worthy of celebration and support, and that as citizens of a democracy, we owe it to all of our fellow citizens to celebrate all of the cultures that live here with a equivalent amount of fervor. And unfortunately, the way public culture developed in the United States, it had almost an exclusive focus on European high art traditions. So the operas and the symphony orchestras and the art museums were prioritized over any traditional culture of any sort, even from white communities, Polish communities or Irish communities or German communities. That wasn't culture that was considered to be worthy of support. And that's a trend which started 100 years ago and is unfortunately very much still with us today. Most of the support, both in terms of individual philanthropy or foundation philanthropy or governmental support, goes to supporting the large Eurocentric organizations and not to the culture that represents most of the communities that live in our city or that live in the United States of America. So my book, Cultural Democracy, talks about the process of how our systems have evolved and robbed us all of access to one of our greatest legacies of our heritage, the music from every community. Here in Chicago, this is a global city. We've got people from every part of the world that live here in Chicago. But if you take a look at a map of the city and where all the nonprofit cultural organizations are in the city, they're all, almost all of them, are in the white neighborhoods. They're not in the Latino neighborhoods. They're not on the south side, the west side. People talk about parts of the city being a food desert. Often in art circles, we talk about parts of the city being a culture desert. It doesn't mean that there's not any culture there. There's a vibrant culture on every single block in this city. It's just that the culture is there isn't getting the kind of support that theater companies up on the north side or organizations like Old Town School of Folk Music are able to access.
Fascinating. I mean, how can that be changed?
Well, I believe the way that it can be changed is that we have to tap these neighborhoods and we have to spotlight them as having those resources. I mean, if in the middle of a desert, you know you need water, and someone knows that you need water, if you can't get to the water, it's their job to bring the water to you. And as musicians, we have to, this is why I go into the community, to find these things, to find the culture, and I try my best to bring it out. I mean, that's that way, when I do so, it now has another avenue, it has another voice. Because if it just stays over here, I mean, what's the saying, if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, does it make a sound? Well, the answer is yes, but no one hears it. So now if I go into the forest and I hear the tree fall, now I can go out and I can tell about it. So by going in and trying to find these culture deserts and bringing them the water, which is the access, then we can get it to grow and then it becomes available.
I've been looking at some stuff lately, though. I mean, to me, one of the most culturally rich neighborhoods in the whole city is Bronzeville, and I've written a lot about that, and I've been through a lot of stories there, whether it be the Harold Washington Cultural Center, or the tearing down of the Regal Theater, or the Parkway Ballroom, and Harlem came back in a big way. Why is Bronzeville so slow in coming back?
Well,
for both of you,
I believe part of the reason why Bronzeville's slow in coming back is because it's taken us too long to figure out that it needs to. from what I read, because I was too young to really remember Bronzeville being vibrant, it used to be a hub. It used to be a social center. And the Bronzeville I knew riding the bus was just, okay, here's 35th and King Drive. There's a sign that says Bronzeville, but I don't know anything about what's going on. Now that I'm working more closely in the neighborhood and I'm teaching in the neighborhood, I see the history. So now here I am, that new fresh pair of eyes. And now other people are starting to see it, whereas there was no jazz clubs in Bronzeville. Now we've got some like it black. And you see people starting to build that up. So slowly, yes, it's coming slowly and it's not rushing in, but progress doesn't happen overnight. So as long as more people just start to put their resources in and discover what was there, it'll come back, and it'll come back quicker the more we do it.
I mean, the late Oscar Brown Jr., his daughter's been on the show, and one of the greatest greatest artists in American history, Oscar Brown Jr., right from Old Town School. You should open up a little storefront place in Bronzeville.
Well, I'll tell you.
I like to think outside the box.
No, you're not thinking too far outside the box, actually. Old Town School adopted a new strategic plan about a year ago, which is a very outward-looking plan, and we've been a Northside institution since Old Town School started, but with a lot of support from our board of directors and our incredibly talented faculty and staff, the school is really looking to move out and develop programs all over the city. We've run a couple of pilot programs in the last 2 years. One of them was an event that put concerts by master folk musicians at L platforms all over the city for people to just stumble upon serendipitously. There's so many great artists that you wouldn't know about unless you were a part of the Guatemalan community or the Romanian community. They might live right around the corner from you, and you don't know that they're a world-class musician. But we wanted to put them out there in public at rush hour so when people could just stumble upon them and say, wow, listen to this Huasteco fiddle player. This is really something else. And then this year we did a project called the 77 Beats. As you know, there's 77 designated neighborhoods in Chicago, and everyone's got its own unique musical flavor, and it's also got its own unique culinary flavor. And we decided to combine those two things together, and we had pop-up events all over town combining the local music and the local food. And some of them were just events that took place in restaurants. Sometimes we'd be out in a city park and have some food trucks come in. And it was just a really wonderful and joyous thing that hooked up food and music all over the city of Chicago, because it's everywhere.
Yeah, that's we got to take a break, but that's really what the Chicago Voices Initiative is about as well, which is all next weekend at various locations. I don't have the web, but they can look it up, Chicago Voices.
Yes, Chicago Voices. I believe it's Chicago Voices at lyricopera.org, but I'll take a look at that and make sure
we're going to take a break. And this is fascinating stuff, so thank you all for coming in, and we'll be right back on WGN.
Well, come on, all you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam, way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books, pick up a gun. You're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly.
Not a little different kind of protest. Yeah, it's all going to die. Not that funny, but that's a great version. Country Joe and the Fish.
Country Joe and the Fish.
I want to say, what, 60, well, I don't know, 67,
yeah,
68.
Probably about 67, maybe 68.
Yeah, yeah.
Right in the height of the craziness.
Bob Graves, Executive Director of the Old Town School of Folk Music, thanks for joining us tonight. And Martez Rucker from Columbia College, who's going to moderate our panel, Modern Protest Songs, Saturday, February 4th. Film Row, 8th floor, 1104 South Wabash, as part of the Chicago Voices series. What's that website, Mark?
The website is chicagovoices.lyricopera.org. That's chicagovoices.lyricopera.org. All of the information on the talks that's been going on around the city and the master classes that will be happening next weekend Once again, chicagovoices.lyricopera.org.
And there's a big concert on the 4th. I know John Prine's playing. Mm-hmm. It's
going to be a nice concert, but I've got to say that I think the panel is really going to be the high point of the Chicago Voices program.
Definitely.
I told Dan Long, I usually don't even type out my notes, but I've been really excited. I just need something to do. You did the Vietnam thing. I mean, you're young, but we've lived through Vietnam. We lived through Nixon. I'm really, really pissed off about what's going on.
I'm telling you, it's crazy.
I really am. I mean, I'm 61 years old. I've never seen anything like this. So how do you guys deal with that, and how do you channel it in your own little worlds, each of you?
Well, here's how I channel it. I realize that there are things that are within my control, and there are things that are not within my control. Now, the things that I can change, personal interaction,
right,
by me showing my light, by me treating others with respect, with dignity, with honor, I touch them. Now, they can touch someone else that I can't reach. And the more that happens, the better off we become, which is, it goes to the heart of the protest song. It's to reach those that we can, and then the song then takes it from there and reaches others that we can't get to. And the more people that are reached by those songs, eventually something's got to happen. And as long as we keep pushing out that positive energy, something's going to happen for the good.
Boy, that's really beautiful. That's really something to reach for. You know, it's funny you said that, and I'll ask the same question to you, but not to get real hokey, but I had some Thich Nhat Hanh stuff here. Exactly what you were talking about, I wrote here. Anger is rooted in our lack of understanding of ourselves and the causes, rooted in desire, pride, agitation, and suspicion, primarily roots of anger in ourselves. When we see and understand those kind of causes, we can begin to be free from our anger. Man, you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah. But the change that you want to see in the world.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Tell us about your projects. I mean, what's going on? You're still playing, Marcus?
I am doing lots and lots and lots of arranging. I have been very fortunate to become friends with the New York Voices, and I've been very fortunate to take over the vocal jazz ensemble at Columbia College. So right now I'm working on a project of arranging tunes from the New York Voices members. Each of them have released solo albums. And I have been undertaking the project of taking one of the most iconic vocal jazz ensembles and writing music for their solo careers. They have this amazing catalog of albums that have been Grammy nominated as a group, but then they've done their own solo projects. Now I want to take those solo projects and write for groups. And I've gotten some help from Peter Eldridge, Kim Nazarian, Lauren Kennan, and Darman Meter. I've gotten advice and doors opened as far as publication. So what I'm doing now is I'm using the resources at Columbia College, the vocal jazz group Chicago Vox, and they will be recording this summer, hopefully 4 to 8 pieces of the Voices, their individual pieces, in a vocal jazz setting. And that's my big baby right now.
And we were talking during the break. I mentioned Maggie Brown and Oscar Brown Jr. You said big influence on you.
Oscar Brown Jr.'s music has been a big influence on my teaching style and my storytelling style as a musician. Sin and Soul and Then Some. Yeah. That's all I have to really say. Sin and Soul is what got me started, hearing Signifying Monkey, hearing Afro Blue and Watermelon Man, telling the stories of the community and making it come to life. And then sitting down with Maggie Brown, we worked together on the Billy Strayhorn story, Sweet Thunder, where we got to act right across from each other, and seeing that history passed down from Oscar to Maggie and seeing how she pushes it forward, it's eye-opening.
Yeah, local treasure.
Definitely.
Maggie. Bao, what's going on in your world?
Well, the thing that I'm the most excited about right now in terms of programs at Old Town School, we've been in the process of developing a program that we're calling Health, Art and Community Wellness, which is using music instruction in partnership with an array of health and human service and community development organizations. So most of them don't have any arts education programs going themselves. And so we're looking for ways that we can bring music education into their facilities and to serve their constituents in a way that will help to amplify their mission in the community and whatever they're doing, bring new people in the door, and allow Old Town School to serve different constituencies than the ones we've been serving up on the north side. So right now we've got a pilot project going down in Englewood with an organization called I Grow Chicago, which is sort of an urban gardening collective. Really wonderful people, nice place. And we come in every week and have hip-hop songwriting workshops and African drumming workshops. Remo, the percussion manufacturer, donated a whole bunch of drums for us, and so we can bring them in to have these young people learn about percussion and songs. And for many of them, it is such an affirming thing. Public performance is an incredible motivator for anybody, but especially for young people. If they've got something that they know that 6 weeks from now or 8 weeks from now, they're going to be performing their own songs in front of their brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts and cousins, it's really a motivator to get people to work hard and focus their energies on what they're doing.
Okay.
And having that experience can really be transformative for a young person.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for coming in. We're going to see you Saturday, February 4th, Film Row at the Modern Protest Songs, Bow Graves, Martez Rucker from Columbia College. Thanks a lot. It was a great segment. We'll see you soon on Nocturnal Journal.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
There's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get on board.